Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded March 6, 2014. There will be a Q&A session throughout today's presentation. Please press star 1 to queue for a question. Please be advised that your questions will be part of the lecture recording. I would like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Craig Cleveland. Welcome, Craig. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Well, good morning, everyone. I don't really know why a funeral director should be part of an oncology lecture, but the two professions between funeral directing and also oncology and palliative care and general caregiving are closely related. What I'd like to talk about this morning is the role of the funeral director, an overview of our role, changes that we've seen from personal, cultural changes and different trends throughout the community. From your slides in front of you, I've added another small topic called challenges we now face as care professionals. And at the end of that section, we'll take questions. And then I've got a second part of my presentation this morning is entitled Caring for the Carer. A lot of people expect us as funeral directors and oncology and caregivers to actually just be able to cope with the death of people all the time. So I'm covering off the topics of the importance of self-care, how do we cope with coping mechanisms that we can put in place, and I'm happy to take questions and receive comments about that part of it as well. So if everyone would like to move to the next slide, then we will start off on the presentation itself. The role of the funeral director, just an overview to start with. A funeral director is the person who gains and organises the uplifting of the deceased, the care during the interval between death and the burial or cremation, which is termed the disposal, and the registration of the death following disposal of the deceased. Anyone can assume this role and oversee the procedure in accordance with local and national legislation. However, the profession of funeral director is much more than a disposal service. You're all aware of the services that we as funeral directors provide you in the community and possibly our role in the preparing of the deceased. Needless to say, our role follows on from yours as care providers, with the variation of our primary care being focused on the needs of the grieving family, and our secondary care objective is to restore and maintain the dignity of the deceased. We provide the vehicle which the community in general and families in particular can recognise the significance of their loss. We provide a service of care to form a fitting farewell and to assist families to recognise and move into the start of the closure stage of the grief process, creating an environment where a family can express their grief with those they choose to have near them for support. In doing this, we must be aware of each individual's spiritual and cultural needs, which may be in conflict with other members of their own family and the community expectations. We become the liaison person for the family and often a confidant and sometimes even a mediator between different family groups. We do not take sides and work towards solutions to create an acceptable compromises. I don't think I've ever arranged a funeral where there's not some form of compromise, whether it be just something small over who gets mentioned in the newspaper notice to major confrontation from, no, we don't want Dad to be buried, yes, we do want Mum to be cremated type of questions and problems. Our role has changed over the years from that of a coordinator, leaving the finer details to others to complete, and being very much hands-off and advice and guidance, to that now of being the chief organiser and producer of the farewell. An average funeral 20 or so years ago took around 12 hours to complete. With the advancement in technology and expectations of our personal role, an average funeral will take now between 20 and 25 hours to complete. Public expectation is now that funeral homes, even in smaller centres, are able to provide chapel and full catering services, DVD recording facilities, digital printing services, high-end audio visual facilities, and the ability for live streaming of funerals, and also having all the technical ability to achieve result equal to any individual professional like a printer. A simple example of this is we're expecting now to locate just about any song a family wants played at a funeral. And over the last 4 years, I've acquired 52 continual days of music, all played at funerals at some time or other, all licensed, downloaded, and paid for. The death culture of New Zealand has been studied widely internationally and is regarded throughout the Western world as a healthy and realist model that enables us to cope with the death process well. We are seen as open and inclusive in our dealing with death as a community. With this realist approach, it has been my experience that we are rarely asked to minimise the appearance of the death of a terminal patient. For example, I've been asked only once in 27 years to perform extensive restoration to the face, neck and hands of a badly emaciated cancer patient to enhance their physical appearance. In cases of a violent death situation, like a motor vehicle accident, restoration of injuries is usually required, but only to a point of acceptance of the accident. Often the appearances of dressed wounds and superficial injuries, such as grazes and bruising, is beneficial in the grief process, as a presentation with no visual signs to relate to often leaves a family with a sense of bewilderment of why did the person die. Sudden deaths such as myocardial infarction, CVA, and many suicides are often like this type of thing with no visual appearance of death or injury, which are often the hardest death situations for families to come to terms with. At the funeral service, it is rare that the circumstances of death are not acknowledged. This acknowledgement affirms to the family what they have been through and empowers the wider family and friends to offer real support and empathy to the immediate family. It's an important part of the closure process. Likewise, the true characteristics of the deceased are freely talked about at the funeral. That does not mean to say that we never observe the situation through rose-tinted glasses, but everyone in death means something special to someone. We all endeavour to do our best and observe the best in others. It's my opinion that the single most important role of the funeral director is to nurture an open and frank communication path between family, funeral director, and funeral officiant to ensure a meaningful farewell is tailored to the family's personal and spiritual needs. And if you would move to your next slide, entitled Changes. These are now a few of my personal observations. I've already touched on technology and professional development and expectational changes in the funeral profession, but across the board, the face of funerals has changed hugely in the past 27 years. For that reason, I wish to focus on three areas of change through my own observations. Firstly, general changes, cultural changes, and then we'll move on to funeral trends and then summarise how that affects us as funeral directors and how we complete our work behind the scenes. My first experience of a funeral was in the late 70s when the death of my grandfather. The funeral director's role was one of information gathering and coordinating. The funeral arrangement itself took about 20 minutes. There was no discussion regarding personalisation of the funeral in any way. It was expected that the funeral be at the chapel, at the church, because there was no chapel facilities anywhere in the town. Viewings were by arrangement only. Boxes were ticked, for example, do you want flowers? Yes or no. No choice of colour, no choice of special flowers. Next, the minister arrived and confirmed the day and time of the funeral. He confirmed the readings and the hymns, which were dictated by the church calendar. The minister, knowing my grandfather, wished to speak of him during the lesson. There was no formal family eulogy. The funeral was completed in around 20 minutes, and the family retired to my parents' home for refreshments. This was very much the norm in those days and not a reflection of poor funeral practice. When I became a funeral director in 1987, the move away from church services was evident. The funeral homes in Whanganui had substantial funeral chapels, and it was uncommon for a loved one to be taken home or even dressed in their own clothes. A shroud and breasting, which is basically a full shirt or a nightie, were the usual attire for the deceased. Viewings were often brief, if at all, and usually still by strict appointment. At the service itself, services were becoming popular and modern music was beginning to be played at the funeral by the organist. There was a move away from pallbearing and families were openly dissuaded from attendance at the crematorium. The closing of the service was often signified by the curtains being drawn in front of the casket and the family being escorted from the chapel by the funeral director. Refreshments were often served in a church hall, a catering lounge, off-site, of course, or still at the family home. During the 1990s, things began to change again. More personalisation of the funeral began to occur, mementos being placed in and on the casket, the deceased being dressed in their own clothing, and viewings became more popular. More and more families were taking loved ones home. By the mid-90s, our funeral home had its own on-site catering lounge. Photos of the deceased were appearing on the service sheets and recorded special music, usually from a provided tape or CD, was being played at the service. Many services were being led by a civil celebrant and cremation was the preferred option for around 55 to 60% of all funerals in Whanganui. At the beginning of the new millennium, technology took over the funeral industry and, as already expressed, the digital age was upon us. We're very proficient with UIT developments, with graphic design, websites, and higher quality of all things technical is now expected from the funeral director. However, along with that, I've noticed a trend back towards family involvement and formal things occurring in the funeral service, such as family dressing their loved one, doing hair and makeup, pulling a casket from the chapel or church, family accompanying their loved one to the final journey to the crematorium, and the need now to place cremated remains in a significant place rather than just scattering them. Personalised caskets, photographic eulogies and playing video clips are now regarded as normal funeral features, as are remembrance book, specific music instead of hymns, and funeral homes now providing full catering facilities on or off-site. Alternative funeral venues such as parks, beaches and family homes have also become popular. Natural burials or environmentally sensitive funerals are much more common. A greater awareness of our environment and the impact we have on it is greatly changing the face of funeral directing. With environmentally friendly caskets becoming more popular and easier to access, and the use of formaldehyde-free preparation of the deceased, we make a conscious move some years ago to minimise the use of plastic within our own firm. We did not plastic line our caskets, and our handles and adornments are environmentally sensitive. Our families are moving in a more cost-aware fashion, and the financial trends of our local community have huge implications on the goods and services and trends. For example, in Whanganui, a steady swing towards cremation over burials continues, with the cremation achieving around 70% in total. Because cremation is a cheaper option, I believe finance is a big driver in the statistics. And if we move to a new slide. Cultural changes. In the 1950s, New Zealand had an assisted immigration policy which saw the introduction of new cultural groups in New Zealand. This continues to change the face of the traditional New Zealand-style funeral. The funeral rites and beliefs of an increasingly diverse community, such as Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, etc., has now led to a greater need by funeral directors to learn and understand the needs of these communities throughout New Zealand. This continues as a learning process for funeral directors throughout New Zealand. And because these families will often engage a funeral director to guide them through the funeral process, we're expected to know their religious and cultural rites. Maori have a marae-based funeral culture, as do Pacifica communities. Over the past 30 years or so, funeral directors have worked alongside these communities to provide a service which enables and maintains this link to their beliefs and expectations. Funeral directors respect the cultural beliefs and expectations of all families we care for. We continue to have a growing awareness and understanding of the many varied cultural rites now practiced in New Zealand. My personal philosophy is that if we do not know what is expected, we respectfully ask questions and engage with a bereaved family to guide us with their specific beliefs. There is no greater mistake than assumption of what is expected of you. This provides a challenge for care providers and funeral directors alike, and I've found it both a challenge and a reward to be involved in cultural funerals. I've gained a better understanding of many religions through my involvement. At the same time, I've noticed an increasing blend of our New Zealand funerals. We're learning from each other the advantages of different aspects of saying farewell to our loved ones, especially the healing of being empowered to care for the deceased, with families dressing loved ones, touching and viewing and taking their family members home. I feel this has been a positive move in the acceptance of death experience. Interestingly, I've also observed a significant move away from marae-based funerals for Maori, with trends towards home and funeral home funerals much more common, and an acceptance of cremation over burial. I believe economics to have had a large part to play in these trends, but I also feel with a large number of urban Maori with no hapu or iwi connection, which has led to this. Many of these families at the time of death look to us for cultural guidance to help them to do the right thing by their culture. Excuse me. New slide, please. Trends. Funerals, like everything else, are subject to continual change. These changes and trends are usually driven by three main factors: cultural, economic, and social. And by social, I mean the local, national, and international tendencies, as well as technological changes. Cultural trends evolve at a slow rate unless a culture centre such as a new Buddhist temple or Hindu centre is established in the area. In these cases, we see a sudden upsurge of traditional cultural rites being observed and then settle into a new cultural normality. This happened in Whanganui with a separate establishment of a Muslim section of the cemetery and their first mosque. Cremation is an example of a cultural trend. Throughout the country, there's been a steady acceptance of cremation over burial. Cremation is no longer dissuaded by the Catholic Church, and we are finding locally more and more Catholic people are choosing cremation. Likewise, more and more Maori Pacific Islanders are choosing to be cremated. The latter could be caused by economic pressure, but I feel also that it could do more with cross-culture acceptance. Other cultural trends include the move away from the traditional church funeral service, with statistics now showing that less than 5% of New Zealanders attend church regularly. Economic trends have an immediate but short-lived effect on funerals. In tight economic times, funerals tend to become less complicated with the use of cheaper caskets, less technology like photo tributes, abbreviated newspaper advertising, and less catering requested. When the economy is not a factor, families tend to explore the many varied options available to them, for example, environmentally sensitive funerals, solid timber and alternative caskets, and natural burials. Social trends are many and varied. The social expectation of the funeral service has changed from a purely religious rite to a more personalised farewell. The eulogy has become the focal part of the service, and often at funerals we hear multiple eulogies and open times of sharing. Poems often replace or complement religious readings, and music that relates to the deceased musical taste is more common now than playing and singing hymns at the service. With the development of technology, computer-generated photo slides and recording the service is now an acceptable norm. 15 years ago, these two things alone were financially restricting. Full-colour personalised service sheets, trinkets placed on the casket, and static displays reflecting the personal interests. I've had vintage cars, motorbikes, and even an old railways jigger at funeral services, fire engines, spinning wheels, and personal artworks. Basically, anything goes. The casket is often also the subject of personalisation, from simple messages being written onto it to custom paint jobs and caskets with personal graphics. We had a hospice patient from Whanganui just recently who had her casket painted purple with graphics of Starship Enterprise all over it. She was carried out to the song Star Trekking Across the Universe, a spoof song sort of aimed from Star Trek days, but it reflected her. Another social trend is the availability of alternative caskets. There are now literally hundreds of choices of casket, from cardboard through to a myriad of green and environmentally sensitive types, onward to plastic and cane, from the extremely simple to the most complex. You only need to type in coffin or casket onto the internet search page and see what you get. And often these expectations are that we have these type of things in stock and they're readily available to us. And often they are, but often we have difficulty getting some of these caskets. Even the venue for the service itself has been subject to personalisation, with a move away from the accepted venues such as church and chapel and graveside or marae to alternative venues. I've completed funerals by the family's choice at sports grounds, the beach, parks, family homes and gardens. These particular changes often pose many logistical changes to the complete the funeral service, with PA systems, perhaps even generators, covered seating, parking problems and gaining the municipal approval, just to name a few. In recent years, a greater awareness of our environment has had an effect in the funeral profession, with green funerals often being talked about. Interestingly, there is no green funeral legislation anywhere in the world, so green is left to local body interpretation. What is acceptable in Whanganui may not be allowed in Wellington. Even individual interpretation of how green do you want the funeral poses a challenge. Our company, like many funeral homes around the country, endeavour to be as environmentally sensitive as possible. And we, as many others do, offer options to families promoting environmentally sensitive funerals. The trend of minimalistic approach to funerals, where there is no formal funeral service and the deceased is taken from the place of death and cremated as soon as possible, was not uncommon now. Throughout the country, this was promoted as a simple and cheap option. It had some support and also appeals to a number of people where the formal goodbye is more of a casual gathering after the cremation. Funerals traditionally were held within a three-day period of death. Due to families being separated by vast distances, it is not uncommon for funerals to be held 5 or 10 days after death now, to allow families time to travel home. These extended time frames can sometimes prove a point of discussion with families, especially if they wish us to take a minimal approach to the preparation of their loved one, and we have a need to care for that person for a long period of time to give all family members the opportunity to view. With further development of live streaming, this trend of delayed funerals may alter and shorten up again, but I feel this will be unlikely, especially in large centres, due to pressure on local cemeteries and crematoriums. For example, in the United Kingdom and United States of America, it is not uncommon for a funeral to occur 2 or more weeks after the death. These changes and trends are not just restricted to Whanganui, but common around the country. So the challenges that we now face as care professionals, they're quite varied and complex. What I wish to talk about now is just a section on how does that affect us with our preparation of the deceased. Every action in life causes a reaction, so it is with the funeral profession. A key role as a funeral director is the need to be able to present a deceased family member at any time to a family who wants to view. This is becoming harder and harder due to the many different medical conditions and the treatments received for them, the length of time presented to us from death to funeral, and the preconceived thoughts by family members to the level of care that we should give in, to their loved ones. Medical advancement is keeping people alive for longer, therefore, often the deceased is in a very poor shape when we receive them into our care, apart from the obvious. Skin tears, pressure sores, severe edema and or emaciation, signs of advanced putrefaction and decomposition in the inguinal regions, hugely sclerotic vascular systems, disfiguring and obstruction caused by advanced tumour breakouts, or patient immobility, shunt wounds and general fragility make for a difficult presentation of the deceased for viewing. The number one challenge we face is when a family wishes us not to embalm or prepare their loved one in any way. In these cases, our only form of temporary preservation is refrigeration. Refrigeration has no infection control properties at all, and will only arrest decomposition if the body remains at a constant temperature of less than 5 degrees. Constant warming and cooling caused by the removal from storage for viewings will increase decomposition. An unembalmed and refrigerated body will show signs of dehydration, body fats will set hard and will dent on touch, and the epidermal layer will feel wet. By wet, I mean clammy to the touch, but more so, the epidermal layer will feel as if it's sliding on the lower connective tissue after about 36 hours following death. Most resistance to embalming is the perceived damage to the environment from formaldehyde and what we do and don't do to the deceased person. We now have available to us formaldehyde-free embalming chemicals, but let me quickly dispel a few myths about embalming. In our embalming process, we use between 1.5 and 3% of formaldehyde by volume. This equates to around 150 to 300 mils of formaldehyde solution in a standard embalming of 10 litres of water. Water is the main carrier. There are other chemicals and buffers and things like that in there to assist with rehydration, etc. But basically, most of the fluid we use is water. Formaldehyde is a natural occurring chemical, and the way it works is by entering a living cell and destroying the protein. You all know what happens when we destroy the protein of a cell. Without protein, the cell won't divide. No cell division, no bacteria spread. Both the protein and the aldehyde, when they come in contact with each other, become neutral. So there is no ongoing work for the aldehyde. Embalming is a temporary preservation measure, not mummification. Not all the bacteria containing cells in the body are destroyed. Therefore, the body will complete natural autolytic decomposition in time. The embalming process is a simple transfusion. We don't suck all the blood out from a person and then replace it with a chemical. As I said, a simple blood transfusion using the body's natural vascular system. Embalming, however, will do the following. It will prevent cross-infection. It will restore a more natural palate of the deceased, remove the discoloration caused by liver mortis and hemostasis. It will temporarily prevent the decomposition of the body. It will give the body a natural look and touch. The body will feel dry, and this is to say the epidermal layer will feel slightly firm, not clammy, and will not move on the connective tissue. The eyes and soft tissues should not dehydrate further, and in some cases soft tissue in the lips, temples, earlobes and fingertips may feel slightly due to the rehydrating elements of the embalming chemicals. If severe edema is present, other specific embalming chemicals can reduce the effects of edema. Diseases such as hepatitis A, B and C, etc., etc., tuberculosis, sepsis, HIV and the MSRA hospital bugs are easily neutralized by embalming, rendering the body safe to touch within 24 hours of the procedure. With the advancement of medicine and technology, we often find a person will present with multiple conditions, such as severe edema in the upper and lower extremities and severe emaciation in the face and torso. In these cases, we're required to take a varied approach to presentation, and we treat each area in its separate needs. There were two conditions we have trouble to control, and they pose the greatest challenge to us as funeral directors and embalmers. The first being jaundice. It presents itself as the great unknown, and colour change often occurs, as you all would have experienced. However, a deceased person who darkens with jaundice will not lighten again, and our only course of action is by masking with cosmetics. Just because the person darkens up, it doesn't mean to say that it is decomposition. It is just the action of the jaundice itself. The second condition, which is every funeral director's fear, is tissue gas or gas gangrene. This condition usually occurs in unembalmed bodies. It can happen almost immediately after death, and usually presents itself within 6 hours following death. It nearly always presents itself the same way, as a crackly feeling under the skin, like crumpling cellophane, along with rapidly distending soft tissue, especially eyes, lips, neck, and genitals. You can literally see them swelling in front of your eyes. Vascular tracking follows, and advanced decomposition and purge follows shortly after. This condition is caused by natural stomach enzymes entering the blood system and is almost impossible to treat, as by embalming in a normal process, we are often circulating the condition throughout the body. So we need to employ a multiple injection site embalming. And it's often just not successful. We will contain odour and stop the purge, but often we must close the casket shortly after viewing because the body continues to react to the enzymes. Throughout the country, we are seeing more cases of tissue gas, and I believe this could be due to the fact that sometimes it's more than 24 hours before we get clearance from medical authority to begin our preparation. I had a body just recently, it was a coroner's case, and it was 5 days from death to the time that we actually got a release from the coroner's office. I won't even start on that kind of problem that we have with grieving families caused by the huge delay. The only disease that we cannot cope with at this stage is CJD. In my career, I've had one non-confirmed but highly probable case of CJD in Whanganui. The World Health Organization recommends that deceased be wrapped, placed in a body bag, sealed in the casket, and to be incinerated immediately. No contact should be made with cerebral or spinal fluid or blood. Studies believe the prions can be found in the hepatic system, therefore making the blood potentially dangerous. There is currently no known method to destroy a prion. Some new medical techniques pose a potential threat to us. Some cancer treatment radioactive implants remain active in the ashes after cremation. It's more of a risk for those at the crematorium or when scattering ashes. Many radiation and chemotherapy treatments cause unexpected results. Things like continual skin peeling, fingernails becoming soft and splitting from the quicks, and the inevitable hair loss. It's not easy to wash and dry and set hair that just keeps falling out. Other treatments either deplete the body's protein levels, therefore the body will not embalm properly, or in cases of many steroids, increase the body's protein level, therefore risking an over-embalmed state. Excessive firming of the tissue giving us a leathery and dry feel. The new implanted defibrillators are very good, but we must know about them before we start our preparation, and they must be deactivated remotely. Otherwise, we risk being burned or shocked by them, as they must be removed, as with pacemakers, prior to cremation. In conclusion, we must work within the parameters of care the client family sets for us, and we endeavour to achieve the best result for them and their deceased loved one. Advancement of skills and change will always occur in all of our professions, and market trends and conceptions will continue to shape our future roles. I look forward to the challenge. Now, time for your questions. So if anyone has a question, please feel free to ask now.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question via the audio, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star 1 to ask a question via the audio. You can also type your question into the Q&A panel on your screen. We'll now pause a moment to assemble a queue. We have a question from the line of Tracy Dyer from Far North Palliative Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi Craig. It's actually Colleen Olsen speaking. I'm the family support worker here. I'd like to know, please, we often have bodies stay with the whānau for a length of time. It's quite warm up here. I'm just wondering what do you consider a safe amount of time to have a body with a whānau unembalmed?
Sure. Difficulty in the answer with that is mainly the circumstances surrounding the death. If the person's been eating in the last few days, then we've got, if you like, more fuel for gas build-up. But the best idea, direct anything is the hardest thing on anyone. So don't put fans on them or don't leave them sitting in the sun. A warm room, a body will naturally cool down to that level. We have that same problem in Whanganui. Overnight is generally okay, but keep an eye on it. When I was talking about the tissue gas earlier, that's something that comes on very rapidly, and if you suspect anything like that that's happening, the first thing you feel is under the skin, that crinkling effect. If you detect anything like that, then get assistance straight away from your funeral director. The earlier we can get onto that, the better, because that's devastating. But, yeah, normally overnight is not a problem. When the days are warm, it's still better to get them into the care of the funeral director as soon as practical. So, you know, if it's 1 or 2 hours or 3 or 4 hours as family are gathering, that's acceptable. But from the other point of view, our preparation from start to finish to the time the person is dressed and everything is often less than 3 hours. So while family are gathering, we can often, with communication with the family, have the person embalmed, family can dress and have them in the casket by the time the travelling family get to the funeral home or to hospice or to wherever. And then they can travel on from there. Most importantly is just the communication. But we're finding in Whanganui the biggest delay is obtaining clearance from doctors.
Yeah, that was
and that's not a reflection to any of the doctors that we're talking, that we're listening in as well.
Okay, because that was my actual next question about suicide and sudden death, that I just want to totally agree that there should be some part of the body that remains to be able to be viewed by the family so that they see the realisation. I actually work for another organisation with the police station as well, so totally understand that and the delay in the bodies. I agree. Turnaround really important. Thank you, Craig.
Thank you. Just a comment from that as well with the timeframes. That should be across the board. Everyone's grief is the same. 5 days is not acceptable for before family gets their loved one back.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have another question from the line of Walter Nazarek from North Haven Hospice. Please go ahead.
Hello, I'm Jan Holwell. I'm a social worker here. My question is a personal one, really. My mother's donated her body to medical science, and I just wondered how that process works. And I have heard that they have too many bodies to take. Have you had any experience recently with?
I'm sorry, I'm having difficulty hearing you. Can you just repeat that slightly louder?
My mother's donated her body to medical science, and just wondering how that process works. I have heard that they have too many bodies donated and can't take them all. Have you had any experience recently with that process?
Yeah, in Whanganui, a lot of people wish to do that in different areas. Apart from the main centres, it's very hard. We had it during the Christchurch earthquake period. We had a Christchurch man move to Whanganui. This sounds like I'm talking sideways, but you'll hear the relevance shortly. We had a Christchurch man move to Whanganui, and it was within his will, and the family were comfortable with the fact about the donation to medical science. But because when he died, it was in Whanganui, that could not happen because it was outside the geographical area. Dunedin Hospital, sorry, covers the Dunedin, Otago area up to just out of Rangiora, I think, is the area of coverage through the Canterbury, Otago area. Auckland Hospital won't take anyone outside, or Auckland University won't take anyone outside of the out of the greater Auckland area. And I believe Wellington, I don't think, has a medical facility there anyway. So it's regional. However, there's other things that can be done. I have heard of body parts being removed, especially eyes and things like that, for research. And that's quite simple. And there was no visual remnants of that the person's eyes have been removed, for example. But the donation is often seen as a very cheap option rather than a practical ability to say farewell. Some people are comfortable with it, others they're a little bit concerned that their mother or father are saying this kind of thing. At the end of the day, the family has the total say in what happens, and the trustees have the total say in what happens, and geographically the demands put on that is the part that actually usually has the final say. And there are a lot of organisations that are saying, no, we've got enough cadavers for the next 3 years.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you. You might need to make some other plans.
There's always a plan B.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
You have a question from the line of Marilyn Beatty from Hospice Tairawiti. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Just an inquiry. Do you notice small families making their own coffins? And if so, what are the requirements for those coffins?
The regulations surrounding burial or cremation is the body must go to the place of disposal in a substantial vessel. We get those inquiries in Whanganui as well. And we have no problem with that, except our reputation is on the line when it comes to the casket staying together. No one remembers the fact that Fred's body fell out of the coffin that he made 15 years ago. People remember they were at a funeral at Cleveland's and the bottom fell out of the casket. So there is no problem with that. I have got two caskets sitting in storage at our work at the moment, made by other members of the public for themselves. I've just heard from one of those families to say that their coffin that Dad made, we're not using that. It looked horrible. So it comes down to personal choice again. I had a beautiful casket made the other day from milled Macra Carpa, which had been sitting on a farmer's farm, and they took it to a joiner. Well, the grandson was a joiner, and in their factory they made their own coffin. The best thing is they talked to us about what the requirements are, because the person was going to be cremated, so the bottom of the casket must be flat so it can get into the cremator, so it doesn't cause a occupational health and safety issue. So this was beautifully crafted. So I've seen some really terrible and I've seen some absolutely beautiful. So we take it on a case-by-case state. And families, and again, it's just down to communication, where families appreciate that, okay, we've communicated with them. If this casket we consider not acceptable because it's going to cause an indecency, because it's going to fall to pieces, we won't use it. But we're quite easy with that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
As we have one question left in queue, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 or type your question into the Q&A panel on your screen. Your next question comes from the line of Trish Fleming from Hospice Worth Auckland. Please go ahead.
Good morning. This is Heather Johnson speaking from Hospice West Auckland. Just like to make a comment. I wonder if you and your listeners have seen the film called Departures. It's a Japanese film, and it is an amazing story about a guy who was made redundant from as an orchestra player, and he ended up being in the funeral business by accident because he answered a job called Departures, and he thought it was a travel agency job. And unwittingly, he got into the business of being an undertaker. It is the most amazing, sensitive, informative film that I think should, that everybody in the business should view for information and for discussion, and I would highly recommend it. Thank you.
Yeah, my own background at the funeral was I'd never ever thought of being a funeral director until I was made redundant from the government department, Ministry of Works, and the logistics came into it where a job opportunity arose. Two children and a big mortgage don't go into the dole at all. So it that was how I got into funeral directing 27 years ago.
And you now have a question from the line of Kirsty Robertson from Hospice Southland. Please go ahead.
Hello, Judith Stewart, spiritual support person at Hospice Southland. Having been a funeral celebrant in the past, I have a huge appreciation for the incredible work that funeral directors do. Our Southland funeral directors work massive hours and give wonderful service. And you've got the image there of the caring for the carer and the lovely bears. How do you look after yourselves? Because I know it's such an incredibly stressful and demanding occupation.
Respectfully, I'll cover this in the caring for the carers because I've put a program together for three rest homes now around the countryside, which is covering caring for the carers, which I have based on what we do at our workplace. So if I could just defer that question until I cover off on the caring for the carer.
Thank you.
And there are no further questions at this time, sir.
Okay, so shall we continue on to the part two, caring for the carer? And if you would change your slide, or move your slide on, that would be good. Some time ago, I worked with one of the major rest homes in Whanganui, whose staff were struggling with a large number of deaths in a two-month period. They had something like 19 deaths in that 2 months. The home had just expanded with a new 35-bed hospital wing, and had been accepting many end-stage care patients. This was a change of the culture for the staff, and they struggled to come to terms with a short stay of the residents and a large number of deaths, which I appreciate is normal for our professions. As funeral director, we have a large volume of people coming through, and likewise with hospice care givers as well, and the palliative care side of things, you are seeing lots of short-term stays and many deaths. These people, though, were feeling a sense of non-connection with the patient and their families. The patients were much sicker, their needs more acute, and often had limited response to the carers. As a result, feelings of numbness and low self-worth within their job was emerging, and many were struggling with high turnover of residents. As funeral directors and palliative care workers, this is considered our normal working conditions. On a day-to-day basis, we cope with the caring and death of a person, pressure of expectations from family, being confronted with often tragic circumstances of death or illness, coping with large numbers of people in a state of grief, and 5, dealing with our colleagues and our own emotional responses. With these points in mind, it's imperative that we care for ourselves to enable us to cope with our chosen vocations. Looking after you is important. It's not always possible to go home and talk about your day. Your family may not always appreciate you telling them each day of the patience you've lost, and if you've not got someone at home to talk to, is another problem. However, it's important you talk to another caregiver or an understanding partner or a friend, someone whose confidence you can be sure of. Treat yourself. Take a long bath, a time out at the movies, a coffee, a time to laugh and talk nonsense with a friend. Look around you, breathe air, and look at the trees, the flowers, the clouds. Feel the wind and the rain. It's not a hard thing to do, but look around at us. In your workplace, consider how you can farewell each patient. On the physical side of things, you can bathe them, dress them, find those important teeth, place a flower on the person, tidy the room, help the funeral director place them on the stretcher, stand in the corridor as they pass to leave the home for their final time, or escort them to the hearse. An emotional, spiritual goodbye is fine as well. Say your private farewell, a prayer or a karakia. Recite a verse, play some special song on the CD, or sing if you wish. These can be done alone or with others. Find a quiet space, the chapel, the patient's room, and a peaceful part in the garden. Another thing that we've suggested to different rest homes and also to ourselves is memorialisation. Talk to others over a cuppa at an informal gathering of staff and a formal mini-service at a special meeting. Light a candle. Have a special scrapbook of names or service sheets. You can attend your local funeral home's annual remembrance service or your own if you have them. Remembering others, sometimes the death of a person we're caring for brings back memories of other more significant deaths. Sometimes in our own family, a close friend or maybe just a particular patient has just touched our lives. This is natural. We often revisit a close death even when we hear of another person's death. This way we continue to appreciate the significance of our close losses. We need to place each life experience into categories of significance, and this helps us to cope and reaffirm our place in relationships and in life in general. There is no time limit to grief. However, if these feelings overwhelm you time after time, it would be important to talk to someone, a manager or a counsellor, who can offer more skills to help you cope with your feelings. So it is important that we put a time frame onto the memorialisation of the death. For example, if a scrapbook is held, hold a remembrance service to remember those people, then dispose of that year's book. At Cleveland Funeral Home, we place our loved ones' names on a special memory card and place them under the memory tree during our annual service. You might think we don't get attached to people that we're caring for, but like yourselves, we sometimes have families that you just crick into and you're quite affected by the funeral service that you're caring for the person with. So I believe there's a feel-good factor that we actually can help us hugely. Accept the praises and thanks of others. When a family gives you a card, place it on the brag board in the staff room. If a family gives you flowers, place them in the staff room. Share the beauty with each other. Token gifts like cards, flowers, and chocolates are for you and your colleagues to share and enjoy. They are the feel-good tokens of our job. You deserve them. Enjoy them. It may sound selfish, but don't share them with families that are at the hospice or that you're looking after. Staff happy hours are a good wind down and should be a work trouble-free zone. You need time with your team to de-stress and enjoy life. This helps to build the team and dispel tension. Encourage an open door policy for problems with each other. Encourage each other and reward each other verbally for a good job. It means a lot. To recognise a tough day and to thank the team for doing their bit is a huge stress reliever and a feel-good response. start a new day by saying good morning to your other teammate members and ask how they are. Find a care buddy, someone you can ring and talk to who knows what your job's like. You know that you can sound off to them and they can sound off to you. A care buddy should never be told the specific details, but it's your vent and then your natter friend. I've got a colleague in Pairua. I ring him quite often, or he'll ring me. I'll say things like, I've had a shit of a week, or I've just had a family from hell. And his reply is usually, tell me about it. I had one of those last week. It always helps to know someone knows how you feel, a vent off. Then we have a brief talk about the problem, and then the all-important catch-up with all the goss and a natter. At our workplace, we encourage all our staff to have a share buddy, and we have no problem with them making calls during work time. These are but a few suggestions, and there's a lot more things you can do that will work for you in your workplace. You all have others, and I encourage for you to share them shortly with each other about things you can do. In the back of your mind, though, just remember this. We all can only hope that when we get to where our clients are, we have someone to care for us as much as we do for others. Is there any questions?
As a quick reminder, press star 1 to ask a question, or type your question into the Q&A panel. There appears to be no questions queued at this time. So would you like to go back to that question from earlier by the line of Kirsty Robertson?
Yeah. So basically how we cope in our workplace is with our care buddies. We talk about it all the time. After any one of my staff has done a funeral, I'll say to them, how did it go? Or after arrangement, how did you get on? Are you okay? It's a continual case of just sharing those experiences you're having with each other, keeping those lines of communication open. It's not easy. I can remember many, many, many years ago, I was involved in an aircraft crash where a friend of mine and her three-year-old were killed in the plane crash. We recovered the bodies after the autopsies had been completed, and I also picked up the belongings of that family as well. And one of the belongings was a pair of gumboots. I had a three-year-old daughter at the time, and when I got home that night, there was exactly the same coloured gumboots and size gumboots sitting at my front door. That blew me clean out of the water. It was nothing to do with the deceased at all, but I was having a case of the guilt, thinking, crikey, I'm so lucky that my daughter's okay and her daughter's dead. So we fight with that kind of emotion. Everyone fights with that kind of emotion. You would do the same when you get a young mother in a hospice care. But it's just that whole ability, most importantly of all, to be able to talk to each other about it, recognise that it's not your grief. And your role is one of a very, very special position of providing the care and dignity to that person. And I think that is what gets us through, is understanding what our role is. And, you know, we can't fix the problem. We're a little bit luckier as funeral directors because, you know, the worst has happened to this person. Once they've died, nothing bad can happen to them. The worst has already happened. So you guys have a harder role than I do because you see them through the death process and you see the families losing a person. So I think you're the ones that need the medal, not me.
We do have two questions that have queued up, sir. We have a question from the line of Alison Buchan from Hospice Wanganui. Please go ahead.
Sure.
Good morning, Craig. It's Marion Taylor from Hospice Wanganui.
Good day, Marion.
Just wanted to thank you very much for a wonderful overview, especially the changes in the social and cultural practices. I found that really interesting. And to thank you very much for the great professional job that you do for us at Hospice Wanganui, particularly that you go the extra mile for us so often. Thank you.
Thanks, Marion.
And we'll take our final question for today from a follow-up on the line from Walter Nazarak from North Haven Hospice. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning. I just have a question about the legal status of a body. I've read in the past on a very odd occasion where bodies have been stolen or even dug up and reburied. And I was just wondering who legally is responsible for looking after the body.
Yeah. The body is owned as part of the estate, so the trustees of the estate have the ultimate control and direction of the body. Where we hear of bodies being stolen and uplifted, and the Christchurch case was a prime example of that, we're talking cross-culture here. And the biggest perception there was that body was taken away taken up north to Gisborne and reburied, and it was completely wrong. Under a cultural belief, the Maori believe that the person should not be left alone, that they should be with family, and that covers off from the time they die to the time they're buried. In the case of the Christchurch, I believe there was no one person's fault, but definitely a breakdown of communication. When the family left the body with the funeral director, it could easily be perceived that they no longer cared for that body, and under cultural requirements, the family who claimed that body would have said, "We care for our brother, and we're going to take him so he can be at home." In Whanganui, we've had one threat of a body to be uplifted from the funeral home, and we got around that by suggesting to the family that they take their loved one home to their house. Once the person was in their own family home, all arguments of ownership and care for that person was dispelled. So we're talking two things. Legally, the body is owned by the trustees of the estate, the executors. And secondly, you've got a cultural perspective, and it's not just the Maori culture that believe things like that. The Muslims believe the person should not be left alone and that the burial should take place immediately. If a person dies, Muslim dies in the morning, they should be buried before sunset that night, or at least within a 24-hour period, and they will not leave the body alone at any time. So we're talking cross-culture here, and yeah, generally we get around it by just clear communication, and when families are, we've got blended cultures, it's our role as funeral directors to actually point out the alternatives and expectation from cultural groups. I hope that answered your question.
Okay, well, that does conclude the Q&A section. I'll just hand back to yourself, Mr. Cleveland, for any additional closing remarks.
Sure. On our final slide that I've got there, if anyone does wish to talk further about my presentation today, feel free to give me a ring in Whanganui, 345-5522, or email me at info@clevelandfunerals.co.nz. And likewise, if you would like to have a copy of this presentation, I have no problems with sharing it. I could talk for hours and hours and hours about my subject as a funeral director in Mbana, and I thoroughly enjoy the topic. So if I appreciate the ability to be able to talk to you this morning, and thank you for asking me along to share my thoughts about funeral directing in relation to palliative care. Thank you very much.
And this does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.